Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Sectarianism renews divisions in the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. By executing a Shiite cleric last weekend, the Sunni nation of Saudi Arabia created a martyr. It also inflamed its dangerous rivalry with Shiite Iran. Hardliners in both countries are now using sectarian differences to pursue political goals. Stability in the Middle East is at stake, along with the Iran nuclear deal, an end to Syria's civil war, and defeating the Islamic State. Both Iran and Saudi Arabia violate human rights and make war on their neighbors. Should the U.S. choose one over the other or look for a middle ground? Today's talking point, advice to families being rounded up for deportation. Don't open the door. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, we're only back with To the Point. Iran and Saudi Arabia are using religious differences to inflame their deep-seated rivalry for power and influence, creating new instability in the Middle East. We'll hear what's at stake for the Iran nuclear deal, Syria's civil war, the fight against ISIS, and America's interests. Today's talking point, U.S. immigration officials are raiding the homes of families who've been told to go back to Central America, but they don't have to open the door. We'll hear why. First is news update. President Obama was visibly emotional today as he announced executive action to tighten the rules for buying guns in the absence of legislation by Congress. In contrast to Second Amendment rights, he listed the right to peaceful assembly and quoted from the Declaration of Independence.
Our unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from high schoolers at Columbine. And from first graders in Newtown.
At that point, he wiped a tear from his eye, then added this.
Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day.
Glenn Thrush is chief political correspondent for Politico. Glenn, good to have you on our program as always.
Good to be here, Warren.
Very serious emotion there on the part of the president, and he talked for a long time.
Look, you know, this is an issue that is probably the most frustrating issue of his presidency. I was in the briefing room back in 2012, right after the Newtown killing, where he had a very similar reaction. You know, these are not just tears of sorrow from the president. These are tears of frustration.
He also quoted from Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the fierce urgency of now, he talked about. That's hardly the way the Congress is looking at it.
Yeah, I think that was from King's book, Why We Can't Wait. The problem here is, and waiting is actually a pretty poignant way to look at this, we're going to have to wait. This is, you know, despite something in the order of 80 to 90% public approval of some increased restrictions on gun access, including background checks and restrictions on mentally ill people having it, the Republican Congress has turned this into sort of the most galvanizing issue, and there's just really no way to get anything passed. That's why this particular menu of options that the president put forward through executive action, which are really quite modest, you know, when you really look at them, you ask, why didn't he do this a couple of years ago? It didn't seem to be anything really new, you know, in terms of anything incredibly forceful. And yet, you see Speaker Paul Ryan and all the Republicans essentially lining up one by one to blast this.
Jeb Bush saying it trampled on the Second Amendment. Ted Cruz saying his pen has an eraser. He'll reverse the action if he is the president. Speaker Ryan, as you indicated, said the president is subverting the legislative branch. What exactly is he proposing then? I know there's closing of a so-called gun seller's loophole. What's that?
Yeah, that's the big one. And to be honest with you, it really doesn't represent the complete closing of the loophole. It's a clarification of the law. You know, for the listeners who aren't familiar with this issue, essentially there's a loophole that allows you to buy guns at gun shows and not undergo these background checks. Well, a lot of the people who buy guns at gun shows turn out to sell them through online marts or private brokerages. So essentially what he's doing is if there's any indication that an individual is doing that activity, such as issuing business cards, something as simple as that, that will empower, through the federal rulemaking process, federal investigators and perhaps even law enforcement to look into the activities of those people.
He's also jacking up the staff in the regulatory agency involved.
Well, Warren, he can't even really do that much. I mean, he can add about 250 more personnel to the FBI's background check department, which is about a 50% increase. But what he really wants to do is add a substantial number of new people to ATF. And that he needs congressional approval for, and he's not going to get it.
So why didn't he do this earlier? You asked that question yourself a moment ago, rhetorically, and it would seem to me we could have asked it many months ago. Do we know? Has he really been waiting for Congress to do something when it's indicated so clearly that it doesn't intend to?
You know, it's a big puzzle to even people who have worked for him over the years, Mark. I remember in 2012... if your listeners recall, the president did not propose a legislative set of proposals to deal with some of the issues brought up by the Newtown killings, including the automatic firearms Brady Bill sort of stuff, until a couple of months after the event, principally because he delegated Joe Biden, the vice president, to basically create a task force and look at the legislative alternatives. At that time, I was covering the White House. There was a lot of frustration in his staff that he would wait and not propose. The president is an innately cautious guy. He's somebody who has not, since Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff of the White House, had a real legislative expediter on his staff. And it is a bit of a puzzlement. And again, as I said before, a lot of these ideas have been on the table for a really long time. The question is, why are we waiting for the last year of his presidency to do this?
Glenn Thresh again, a chief political correspondent for Politico. Thanks, as always, for being on our show.
Thank you.
Apology to our listeners for the quality of that transmission, but I think we could understand everything that Glenn Thresh had to say. In a moment, sectarianism renews divisions in the Middle East. This is To the Point from PRI.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide, 24/7, online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Last Saturday, the Sunni nation of Saudi Arabia executed a Shiite cleric who had been openly hostile toward the royal family. Mobs in Shiite Iran attacked the Saudi embassy. The supreme leader of Iran is being accused of making statements that encouraged those attacks. Now, other nations are taking sides with potentially dangerous consequences for stability in the region. Scott Peterson is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's author of Let the Swords Encircle Me, Iran, A Journey Behind the Headlines. Scott Peterson, welcome back as always.
Thank you.
What's at stake here now with this new instability in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, I think just when you thought that that Saudi-Iran relations couldn't get worse, and we've seen how difficult they've been over recent months, certainly with the death of hundreds of Iranian pilgrims on the Hajj some months ago, and a lot of other issues culminating in the Syrian peace talks late last year. There's been a lot of tension, so one wouldn't have thought that the relationship could get worse, but now we have this incredibly provocative set of actions, first on the part of the Saudis and then in reaction on the part of the Iranians. So, you know, we are expecting, and we've already begun to see ripples across the region. We've begun to see both sides polarization, shall we say, certain countries that are allied to Saudi Arabia cutting off ties, lowering their relationships with Iran. We've also seen on the other side, Iran and hardliners among them being very, very critical of Saudi Arabia and truly the sectarian flames burning higher now than they were certainly 5 days ago.
You said that the original execution, of course, was provocative and that Iran then had a provocative response. And now today, out of Tehran, word is coming that a commander of the very hardline military group in Iran has condemned the storming of the embassy as an ugly, unjustifiable act. What does that mean? Is Iran sort of backing off?
Well, I think we've actually seen revealed here quite a few of the divisions among the conservatives themselves. I mean, I think for the hardest of the hardliners, I think they probably saw this event, the sacking of the embassy, as kind of a win-win, because for them, they detest President Hassan Rouhani. They detest his effort to try and re-engage with the West, also with Saudi Arabia, with Gulf nations, and kind of open Iran up. So one thing that they felt or that they would have calculated is that by striking the embassy, this is going to undermine his bid to do that. And the other thing, of course, too, is that they also at the same time were able to give Saudi Arabia a bloody nose. But the fact that you've had this Revolutionary Guard commander saying, you know, that this was a wrong and unjustifiable act. We've also had one of the most strident hardline Friday prayer leaders also saying that, you know, embassy shouldn't be sacked. This is kind of from a bygone era. Protests on the street are fine. And then at the same time, you've also got other hardline voices. For example, the editor of the of Kayhan newspaper, which is very, very close to the Supreme Leader's office. And he was saying that he hopes that Saudi bases and even princes traveling in America and Europe are targeted for the blood of this sheikh. So really a mixed messages coming from conservatives in Iran.
Scott Peterson again, a Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Max Boot is a senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Max Boot, as always, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back.
You have written in Commentary Magazine, apropos of the situation that we're talking about, that Saudi Arabia, regardless of what happened on Saturday, is an American ally of necessity. Let's first go to the execution itself. Was it justified?
Well, it's hard to say that it's justified because, you know, the entire Saudi judicial system inspires no confidence. It's arbitrary. It's biased. It's not fair and impartial. And, you know, the question of Nimr al-Nimr's activities remains open. I mean, his supporters say that he was entirely a peaceful advocate of change. Others suggest that he has advocated violence. But certainly there's nothing that he did that obviously calls out for the death penalty.
So why shouldn't the U.S. then condemn Saudi Arabia for this? It has really not taken very strong, had taken a very strong position.
Oh, I don't object to the U.S. condemning Saudi Arabia for this. I think that's legitimate. I mean, I think this is a human rights abuse, no question about it. But what I'm still waiting for is a strong condemnation of the Iranian action and allowing a mob to enter, ransack, and firebomb the Saudi embassy in Tehran, which is a violation of the most basic norms of international conduct. And I have not heard the State Department forthrightly condemn that. Instead, what I'm hearing is that the administration is basically trying to take a neutral stance between Saudi Arabia, which is our longstanding traditional ally, and Iran, which since 1979 has been the number one enemy that the United States has faced in the region and remains today the number one enemy that we face in the region. And that kind of neutrality, that kind of moral equivalence is, to my mind, misguided, because even though the Saudi regime is deplorable in many ways, and I deplore it, the Iranian regime is worse, both from a human rights perspective, where it's, you know, killed, been backing the Bashar Assad killing machine in Syria, which has killed over 200,000 Syrians, and Iran is fundamentally committed to the ideal of death to America, whereas Saudi Arabia has been and remains an American ally. And so not to choose sides between them, I think, is a fatal mistake.
Let me introduce Robin Wright, joint fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace at the Woodrow Wilson Center, also a contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine. Good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Do you see any compromise coming out of Iran? Do you agree with Max Boot that it is our enemy, Saudi Arabia is our traditional ally, we should hold our nose and be supportive of Saudi Arabia?
Look, both countries engaged in what are fundamental violations of international law and human rights. The question is, how do you contain the damage? And I think that's what the administration has been struggling to do. It's very hard to have much impact on Saudi Arabia. You have a new king who has engaged in a more aggressive agenda, whether it's in Yemen or in, you know, trying to undermine the nuclear diplomacy. But you also have an Iranian regime that where the United States has been a victim of another embassy attack and a prolonged hostage ordeal. The administration has reached out to both sides to try to contain the damage, most of all because of the rippling repercussions on four very delicate peace processes. Most importantly, the Syrian talks that were scheduled to get underway on January 25th. The Iraqi progress for the first time, both primarily militarily, but also a bit politically against ISIS. The Yemen peace process that was derailed the same day as the execution of Sheikh Amr when the Saudi coalition decided to withdraw from the ceasefire, which hadn't held very well anyway. And then the Iran nuclear deal, which was supposed to be implemented this month. The stakes of this confrontation are much bigger than the longstanding tensions that have erupted between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Let me go back to Scott Peterson with the Christian Science Monitor. What about the American reaction to what's going on? Max Boot says that they're attempting to maintain a sort of neutral stance. He finds that a moral equivalence between Saudi Arabia and Iran that he finds unacceptable. What have they said in each case?
Well, I think what they are trying to do is, and I think Robin is right in this respect, is what they're trying to do is make sure that these tracks, these several different tracks and these several different conflicts, which have been ongoing and were beginning to show just a little bit of promise in the last few weeks regarding both Syria and Iran, you know, that those things don't get completely set aside by or, you know, by distracted politicians and by a lot of rhetoric that's coming out from these two sides. I mean, each one of these fights that we've been talking about in the region are really proxy wars in many aspects, certainly Syria and Yemen to a degree, and even Iraq in many respects. And those are the, you know, those are the kind of things that are causing so much destabilization, that have caused such an exodus of refugees out. So I think that, you know, what the White House and the State Department are trying to do is simply trying to, you know, contain, you know, really contain the damage and not declare who or, you know, who is not responsible. We understand that the White House definitely tried to convince the Saudis that now is not the time. I mean, after all, they had they arrested Sheikh al-Nimr in 2012. He was given the death penalty sentenced in 2014. So why did it have to happen this week, you know, which is such a surprise? And we also understand that it's been reported anyway that Saudi Arabia put all of its security forces on alert and essentially prevented anyone from going on holiday starting on December 31st in anticipation of the fallout that they were anticipating from this. So why did they still do it? It's hard to say. But ultimately, I think what the White House and the State Department are trying to do is just trying to prevent this from getting in the way of everything else that was already as complicated as you could possibly imagine, now all the more complicated.
So, Max Boot, what's wrong then with trying to keep this thing somewhat under control by not taking firm sides with either Saudi Arabia or Iran?
The problem is that Iran is bent on a campaign of expansionism across the region. The new Iranian empire stretches into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon. The Sunnis of the region are running scared, including, of course, Saudi Arabia, the leading Sunni Gulf Arab state. What they perceive is that the United States is, in fact, taking sides, that we are aligning with Iran. We signed a very generous nuclear deal with Iran that allows Iran to keep its nuclear program, with all limits being lifted in 10 to 15 years. And in the meantime, as soon as a few weeks from now, Iran is going to get over $100 billion in sanctions relief. We are not pushing back on Iran, which is test-firing missiles near the USS Harry Truman battle group in the Persian Gulf. We are not pushing back on Iran holding five Americans hostage. We are not pushing back on Iran letting a mob burn the Saudi embassy in Tehran. So the Saudis feel embattled. And a lot of the reason why I believe that they executed Nimr al-Nimr is, in fact, because they feel that Washington is allowing Iran to have a free hand, and they need to push back against this growing Shiite-slash-Iranian power grab in the region. And so by standing on the sidelines and making it seem as if we are abandoning our traditional allies, we are, in fact, apparently, from the standpoint of the region, giving a green light to Iran for the kind of aggression that it is pursuing in Syria, where it is backing the Assad killing machine, which has killed over 200,000 people and is driving Sunnis to despair, and many of them to align with terrorist groups like the al-Nusra Front or ISIS. This is this radicalization, this polarization of the region, which is going on because the United States under President Obama has effectively ended our traditional role post-1979 as a de facto check on the expansion of Iranian power. That is the underlying dynamic, and it is a very dangerous dynamic.
Robin Wright, back to you. What about the firing of those missiles, test firing of those missiles, so close to American ships, the keeping of the hostages, for example, and the other things that Max Boot lists? Certainly that isn't the behavior of an American ally.
Of course not, and the United States has will continue to impose sanctions on Iran because of its human rights abuses. It's at the top of the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and because of its missile program. These are continue to be issues even if the nuclear deal goes into place. So it's not as if the embassy is going to open anytime soon. I do think that while Max is right about all of these issues, that there is something much bigger at play here, and that is this longstanding animosity between countries that have a split when it comes to Sunni Shiite. They have a split ethnically when it comes to Arabs and Persians. It has to do with the importance of the place they hold in the region. Until 1979, Iran was one of the two pillars of U.S. policy, along with Israel, in the Middle East. After 1979 and its revolution, Saudi Arabia and Egypt took that place to fill the void. Because of the jacked up prices of oil in the case of Saudi Arabia and after the peace process with Israel in the case of Egypt. And Saudi Arabia is very nervous about Iran coming back into play. It has a population Iran has a population at least three times larger than Saudi Arabia. It has a larger military, even though it's not nearly as well equipped. And it has a consumer market that is the kind of last gold mine on earth, and that a lot of Western companies want to get into. And so Saudi Arabia is not just because of the kind of classic reasons for antipathy, it is as nervous about losing its stature, its place in the region, particularly at a time that oil prices are so low, and the United States particularly is less dependent on imported oil.
Let me go back to Scott Peterson very briefly, because we don't have a lot of time before you need to leave us. You're in Turkey at the moment. That's a Sunni Muslim nation that hasn't had much to say about all of this. What's the impact there? A very important country, a member of NATO.
Well, I think that they're kind of watching for the moment while they're not in the spotlight, because, of course, Turkey has been facing all of its own issues, especially with ISIS coming across the border and being allowed into Syria for years. By Turkey. So they've had all kinds of their own security and other issues. And so they're looking across. Of course, there are no fears here of Iranian influence. And one point that I would contest is this concept, this idea that Iran is somehow on the march because of its own designs, or that it's orchestrated some extraordinary empire building effort. I mean, basically, Iran has been a reactive nation for many, many years. In fact, for many of those decades. And if you look at the roles it's played in Iraq, if you look at the role it's played in Yemen, for example, everywhere except Syria, it hasn't been able to actually create the kind of end game or end state that it so desired at the beginning. So
okay, hold that thought, if you will. We need to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation on our talking point later. The roundup for deportation continues, and immigrants are being warned now, don't open the door. We'll hear why that's the case back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW Radio.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. For the moment, Scott Peterson with the Christian Science Monitor is still with us, speaking to us from Turkey, because I wanted to get a reaction from Max Boot to what Scott Peterson just said with regard to Iran. And Max Boot, he contradicted your contention, said Syria is not on the march to empire, that it has been a reactive nation for many decades. How do you respond to that?
I think that's just a fundamentally flawed reading of Iran's post-1979 history. Which, remember, began with the revolution. One of the major acts of the revolution, of the Iranian Revolution, was an act of aggression against the United States, the taking of our embassy and the hostages in Tehran. And remember that one of the first things that the Iranians did after consolidating the revolution at home was to start expanding their influence abroad. They have something called the Quds Force, or the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Force, whose job it is, in fact, to export the Iranian Revolution. This is why Iran has become the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world in the course of the 1980s and 1990s, acting through its proxy, Hezbollah. Iran has grabbed de facto control of the state of Lebanon. It is now extending that same strategy into Syria and into Iraq, using local Shiite militias as proxies for Iranian power to allow the Iranian state and its agents to effectively take control of the regimes in both Damascus and Baghdad. It is now trying to extend that strategy into Yemen. So Scott Peterson may not think that looks like an offensive, but believe me, to everybody else in the region, to all the other Sunni states, and as well, of course, as to the state of Israel, they all see an Iranian offensive that has been going on since 1979. And what they also see is that in the last few years, under President Obama, the U.S. has stopped actively trying to counter the Iranian offensive and instead has tried to make nice with Tehran, which has delivered a very generous nuclear deal to Iran that will deliver more than $100 billion worth of sanctions relief shortly to Iran, which will provide more funding to enable this Iranian power grab, which is now going on, this bid for regional hegemony.
Okay, let me go back to Scott Peterson. He needs to leave us, as I indicated, and let him respond. Go ahead. There's a lot of material there for a very short period of time regarding Iran's history since 1979.
Well, I mean, you know, of course, the original project, as Max correctly pointed out, it was to export the revolution. I mean, the thing is that, you know, pretty much any Iranian will tell you that that project has failed miserably, and Iranians have been aware of that for more than 15 years. So that kind of ability to project soft power, that ability, of course, you know, Iran has been a specialist at creating proxy forces. I mean, this is the reason why we see Afghans, we see Pakistanis, even Iraqis, of course, also fighting, you know, under the Shiite banner inside Syria. This is an impressive way of operating when, in fact, you aren't able or prefer not to use your own forces. So Iran has definitely mastered that. But in terms of the ability to convince people to follow them, exercise the kind of cultural soft power or otherwise, you know, kind of create allies on the ground, Iran has failed miserably. And I've heard this so many times from Iranians who just say, you know, they can't do it. And people, you know, people in the region constantly are talking about how much suspicion they have toward the Iranians and toward their intentions and everything else. And Iraqis, for years, when we heard, you know, when we heard U.S. officials and others say, well, you know, Iran is on the march in Iraq and everything else, it was the Iraqis who would say, we'll never let them get very far because we are Iraqis first before we are Shiite or before we are any other sectarian group. And you see this in a lot of different organizations. So I really do think that picture needs to be, you know, kind of understood in a correct format. And it's simply not correct to think that there's, you know, some strategic power grab going on that Iran has so cleverly orchestrated.
All right. Some very different views, obviously, with regard to a very important country. Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, talking to us today from Turkey. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Let us return to the conversation about Saudi Arabia. Ali Al-Ahmed is with us. He is director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He himself is a Saudi living in this country now because he is a dissident and has spoken on our program before. It's good to have you back, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
What do you think the Saudis were doing when they executed Sheikh Al-Nimr?
My contention is this was for domestic purposes mostly, because what happened days before the execution, I knew the executions were taking place. A lot of people knew that. I was not the only one. But The timing was important because it was 4 or 5 days after the Saudi budget. The Saudi budget was horrible. It was less than the last year's. It had a 36% deficit. The government introduced higher rates for electricity and for gasoline, and they are set to introduce more taxes. So that created a lot of shock inside the country, including those who are supporting the monarchy, because the Saudi government has in its hand a failing war in Yemen. Their project in Syria is not going well after the Russian intervention. Iran is rising. Their project in Iraq also is not working. So in order to detract and to deflect from those failures, I think the executions were carried out to tell the people that we are still in charge and you dare not criticize us, and rally people around the flag in a way around the issue of terrorism. And Sheikh Nimr was added there, so it's not an issue of only killing Sunnis or killing Shia. They already had him on a death in death row, and they wanted to get rid of him at the same time. So he was not targeted per se, but it was mostly for domestic consumption.
Again, he was not the only one executed. There were 46 others who were killed as well, should point that out. But the United States apparently did try to suggest to Saudi Arabia that this was a bad idea, in part because it would lead to the kind of reaction that happened in Iran. Why would they ignore that? Why go ahead? Wouldn't it be enough to just execute 46 people? Did they have to include Sheikh Nimr as well?
I think the United States did not, from my knowledge, because I actually did meet with them and I wrote about it, and I had several meetings regarding this issue, which I said is to the State Department that this, you know, you should not only ask for Nimr and the Shia protesters, but you should ask for everybody, because this is important. The sectarian balance in the region is very important. I don't think they did what they should have done. A family member of a Nimr said yesterday that Obama should have gotten involved. If he had gotten involved, or Kerry, I think those executions would have been delayed. But the U.S. government did not see that issue as important. I think they didn't really understand the repercussion.
You don't think they were taken by surprise?
I doubt it, because I was telling them that this is happening, and I gave them evidence this is happening at any moment. And the Saudi media or the Saudi security apparatus were leaking the executions, mass executions are going to take place in the next few weeks, which turned out to be correct.
Tell us, if you will, about the leadership of Saudi Arabia now. It seems to be in a sort of state of transition.
It is in a state of transition. You have an effectively two governments, two cabinets, one headed by the Saudi Crown Prince and Minister of Interior, Mohammed bin Nayef, through what they call the Committee for Political and Security Affairs. The other cabinet is led by the son of King Salman, the Minister of Defense, and the Deputy Crown Prince. This is the Economic and Development Committee. And so there is sort of infighting there. There is competition, I wouldn't call it even infighting, between these two. And Mr. Bin Salman, he fears that if his father dies, he will be ousted, just like his uncles were. So he wants to ensure his place. And I think that could lead him to do reckless things, just like the war in Yemen and the executions. Because I think these are actions that reflect instability in the leadership.
So what do you expect now from Saudi Arabia? And did they get what they wanted as a result of the executions?
I think the Iranian reaction helped them a lot, because they wanted to frame this into a Sunni Shia regional fight with the Iranians, and they did that very well in the 1980s after the Iranian Revolution, when they encouraged Saddam to invade, and they created this sort of narrative of Persian versus Arab and Shia versus Sunni. Now I think they are trying to do the same, because this is the best insurance for them. they don't have much to offer in terms of economic largesse to the people. So they busy their population, especially their Sunni population, with the fear that Iran is coming to get us, and we need to rally around the flag. We need to suck it up, even economically. We need to suffer. And today the king brought all the top guns, the religious leaders of the Wahhabi institutions, as a show of force that we are united against the Iranians.
So, Robin Wright, back to you, joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center, contributing writer to The New Yorker magazine. Did Iran then sort of fall into a trap?
Well, look, this comes at a very interesting time for Iran, and there's an election due next month that will determine not only the balance of power between, you know, the kind of centrist reform on one side, the hardliners and conservatives on another, but it will also probably elect an assembly of experts that will determine who the next supreme leader is. So there's a lot at stake here. And the timing is terrible for Iran. They thought this was the month that was going to see the implementation of the nuclear deal and the beginning of the lifting of sanctions and the easing of its status as a pariah nation. And instead, it finds itself cut off from some of its Gulf neighbors, being criticized by governments around the world, and also split once again between those trying to get the revolution back into a state of a normal nation versus the hardliners who are wedded to the export of the revolution. This is the timing of this really stinks at a lot of different levels.
What about the nuclear deal? Is Iran taking the actions that it was supposed to according to the schedule laid out in the agreement?
Well, it's actually done more than that. The State Department and other partners in the six-nation coalition that engaged with Iran have said Iran is ahead of schedule. It's expected that they will complete compliance on dismantling certain aspects of their program, dismantling centrifuges, exporting low-enriched uranium sometime this month, and that then signals the beginning of what they call Implementation Day. But who knows how this is going to affect all kinds of things in the region, whether it will slow the process, whether it's the peace talks in Syria, or, you know, complicate any of them, any or all of them.
So, Max Boot, back to you at the Council on Foreign Relations. Nobody is suggesting that Iran will become an ally of the United States, but you said it's so much worse than Saudi Arabia. What about the fact that it is ahead of schedule on the Iran nuclear deal, which I know you were opposed to? Wouldn't the United States be upsetting that arrangement and making it more likely that Iran would, in fact, develop nuclear weapons or try to develop nuclear weapons if, in fact, it came out very strongly in this particular situation?
Well, let's be accurate about what Iran has done since it signed the nuclear deal last summer. It has test-fired long-range ballistic missiles in violation of United Nations sanctions, and we have backed down from any attempt to hold them accountable for that. It's continued to hold five Americans hostage. It's continued to pursue a very aggressive policy backing war crimes that are being committed in Syria.
Okay, excuse me for interrupting, but Robin Wright, what about that? We've heard that litany elsewhere on the program. Test fired the missiles, violated the UN sanctions as a result. That doesn't sound like an effort to try to keep things calm.
No, and all of that is true. The missiles are not part of this nuclear deal, and the Iranians have said they are not in a position to negotiate their missile program, which they see as a defensive instrument. I mean, I'm not saying that's true, but that's what they will say. On the five Americans held, there have been some attempts to try to broker a release. They have not been successful. That is clearly a huge problem for Washington. Our differences with Iran are not going to change very much. The only thing that will be hopefully taken off the table is its nuclear capability, at least for 10, 15, or 25 years.
Okay, Ali Al-Ahmed, back to you. You're a Saudi yourself. Do you think that the Saudi regime is, in fact, with all its failings, at least a better ally for the United States in the Middle East than Iran. Not that Iran is going to be an ally. Nobody is suggesting any such thing. But how would you strike the balance?
I don't know the word ally applies anymore to the Saudis, because I think that was true at one time during the Cold War. I think they helped the United States, and I wrote an article about it in the Washington, in the New York Times today. They did serve the United States' strategic goals vis-a-vis the red threat, the communist threat at the time. But at this time, I don't know. The Saudis, if you look at their policies, I do not disagree very much with the sort of with the Iranians, but look what the Saudis have done. They undermined the American project in Iraq. They continue to support extremists. There are at least 10,000 Saudis since September 11 who are members of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Look what they have done to Yemen. They destroyed the sort of the example that the Obama administration was talking about. Now Al-Qaeda is controlling three Yemeni provinces due to the Saudi bombing, and ISIS is continuing to grow there. In terms of if you compare Iran to Saudi Arabia, in many ways, Iran is not going to be an ally, but Saudi Arabia is a friend that is creating more problems for the United States in terms of security and terrorism. They were angry, and they're behaving like they're extorting the United States. Oh, why don't you support Mubarak? Why don't you overthrow Assad? Why don't you take on Iran? The United States is not the bully hired by the Saudis, but that's how the Saudis view the United States, is you have a duty to protect us. And I think that mindset should change, and I believe that if the U.S. kind of reshift its policy in the Middle East to working with nations like Iran and Saudi Arabia as partners, not as allies, as just like they deal with the Chinese or with the Russians or, with the South Africans. I don't think they should give anybody special status, because that special status really has damaged U.S. Standing in the region as a democracy, and a democracy that can sell the people in the Middle East books instead of arms.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that, and I'm sorry, because obviously there are such marked differences between our guests, but that's the nature of our program, and we have heard a lot from all of you, and I want to thank you very much for being on our program. Ali Al-Ahmad, Director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs in this country, formerly from Saudi Arabia. Max Boot, Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Robin Wright at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center. Great to have you all, and thanks to Scott Peterson with the Christian Science Monitor, our earlier guest. As well. On the Mexican border, the U.S. is seeing another surge of immigrants from Central America, including unaccompanied children. Immigration officials are trying to send the message that they should stay home. We'll hear what that means for those who are already here with their families. Back in a moment with today's Talking Point.
If you love discovering new music, check out the KCRW Music Mine. It's KCRW's first iPad app, dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine takes you into a galaxy of audio, video, and photos of artists from the KCRW playlists, with rolling updates so you can uncover what's next and keep up with the artists you love. Discover, listen, share in the Music Mine, KCRW's free iPad app. More info at kcrw.com.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. In the past, U.S. immigration officials have raided workplaces to find immigrants who've been ordered to leave the country. Now they are raiding the homes of families with children from Central America. Sonia Nazario is a journalist and author of Enrique's Journey. She sits on the board of Kids in Need of Defense. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
People are being told that when the immigration officials show up, don't open the door. Why that advice?
Well, I think many people who are being deported, and let's be clear: if you have a deportation order and you are deemed to not be allowed to be in this country legally, if you have had a fair process in court, you should be deported. But many of these families have not had a fair process in court. They sometimes don't even get a notice of their court hearing and where to go until the court hearing is over. And oftentimes they are showing up in court with no legal representation to argue these very complex immigration asylum cases, which is impossible. And so it is not a fair process. And so these groups are advising, as well as the Guatemalan government, El Salvadoran government, if ICE, immigration enforcement, shows up at your door, do not open the door. If they claim they have a warrant, ask them to slip the warrant under the door, or just don't answer if someone knocks at your door at all. That's the advice they're giving.
Do the immigration authorities then have to simply walk away, or can they break down the door?
Well, there have been reports that they're breaking down some doors, but largely I believe they do walk away.
I understand that about 120 people in Georgia, Texas, South Carolina have, in fact, been involved in all of this. Why in those places?
Well, I think those are places that in recent years have had the largest influxes of immigrants and therefore the largest backlash towards immigrants, especially North Carolina, Georgia, fairly, you know, conservative southern states. North Carolina in the 1990s saw the largest jump in undocumented unlawful immigrants in the country and a very severe backlash. And Texas, where we've seen these raids as well, it's one of the few states that's had an increase in unlawful migrants in recent years. The numbers have been trending down, but it's one of the few states that saw an increase. So it's very predictable. You see an increase in the numbers, and these are some of the places that have seen the largest increases, and you see the resulting backlash. And so they've gone first to the places where they have the greatest political support.
When you say that the process is so often unfair and that people don't get legal advice, or in some cases don't even get notice that they are supposed to attend a hearing. What's the reaction to that among people who are supportive of immigrant rights?
Well, I think most people who are supportive of immigrant rights fully understand that people who are coming from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras are fleeing severe and growing violence. These are some of the most violent places on earth. They have the highest homicide rates in the world after Syria, the highest kill rates in the world after Syria. El Salvador has violence that rivals the time of the Civil War. I covered the Civil War in El Salvador, and people describe streets being littered with bodies and whole villages being wiped out, and that's the level of violence that some of these communities are seeing. And so they understand, and the UN has said that a majority of these, especially children coming unaccompanied to the United States from these countries, that 60% of them likely merit international protection. They are not largely economic migrants. I separate an economic migrant, someone coming for a better life, to a refugee, someone who is fleeing for their lives. And so many of these folks have been threatened by gangs that control large swaths of these countries, or the narco cartels that many of these gangs now report to. So they understand that these people are not coming willingly. They are fleeing for their lives, and they likely merit international U.S. protection. But when they go before these courts, most of them cannot afford an attorney. And if you're an immigrant, you're not entitled to a government-funded attorney. And so about three-quarters of these women who are going to court with their children and half of these unaccompanied children are going to court, immigration court, to plead their asylum cases with no legal representation. Immigration law is more complex than tax law. Most Americans will be delving into doing their taxes soon, and we understand how complex that is. I mean, I've heard judges say that many immigration attorneys don't fully understand immigration law. And here we're asking an uneducated, in many cases, woman or a 7-year-old child to stand before that judge and argue a complex asylum case. This is not due process. This is a mockery of our judicial system. And if people don't have a lawyer representing them, as most of these folks do not, this is not a fair process that we're putting them through.
All right. There appears to be another influx, a surge, if you will, of unaccompanied children arriving at the border now, as we heard last year and the year before. Do you think that means that people in the countries you mentioned, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, just aren't getting the message?
I think that they understand that if they arrive to the United States, if they can get into the United States, even if they go to court, if they simply get a deportation order and blend into the woodwork, they'll be able to live here unlawfully. It will be difficult. And yes, that rankles many Americans, and I understand why it rankles Americans that you've gone through a court process and you're not abiding in the end by that process, although, as I said before, that process is quite unfair. So I think most people recognize that if they can get here, most of them will be allowed to stay. I think the U.S. is doing this because they feel that they're freaking out over the numbers going up. We're seeing in December a more than doubling in unaccompanied minors over the same period last year coming to the United States unlawfully. And in the last year and a half, what the United States has done is we have paid Mexico to engage in a ferocious crackdown and try to stop these folks from arriving at our border. And Mexico has really hunted these folks down like animals and sent them back, in many cases, deporting them, the U.S. and Mexico. When people are deported, they are sent back to their deaths.
Do you think this will increase the sanctuary movement in this country?
Yes. What we're seeing, and in fact, 2 days after the report came out in the Washington Post that the U.S. government was going to be doing these roundups, there was an announcement by a multi-denominational group that a new sanctuary movement was arising that is at least 50 churches in 12 cities. And really, this is coming out of Tucson, Arizona, a Presbyterian church, which in the 1980s really spearheaded the sanctuary movement back in the 1980s, when people were fleeing Central America because of the wars in those countries. That same church is spearheading this new movement, and I really applaud that, because even the Pope has said in Europe, if Syrians are fleeing harm, churches should take in families who are fleeing harm. These are churches who are engaging in civil disobedience and saying to our government, what we are doing to these refugees is unfair. And by the way, President Obama said in November, slamming the door in the face of refugees would betray our deepest values. That's not who we are.
Okay.
It's not what we are going to do as a nation, referring to Syria, but it's exactly what we are doing when it regards Central Americans fleeing harm.
All right. We are running out of time. Fonda, thank you very much for being on our program. Sonia Nazario, author of Enrique's Journey, also on the board of Kids in Need of Defense, which attempts to supply attorneys to some of the people we've talked about. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.